reach for. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's on 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting in the USA. This way, and he's fighting for democracy or fighting for the red. He says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, in a war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him, and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end.
Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. Earlier this week, I was chatting with a friend. We somehow got into the if-onlys. You know what I mean? If only such and such were true, everything would be better. Or, if only such and such weren't true, everything would be better. Or even, if only everything were better. But we know it takes quite a lot for things to be better, actually. It takes belief or faith or drive or whatever you want to call that part. It takes determination or, well, you know, you might have called it work. It takes a lot of belief and a lot of work, probably some luck too. It takes people working together. Well, the if-onlys led my rapidly shifting attention to a poem that I remembered reading a long time ago. I certainly didn't read it at the time it was written. I'm not quite that old. But I think this is a pretty good poem and worthy of being read aloud today. So that's what I'm going to do. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. If you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too. If you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken, and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they're gone. And so hold on where there's nothing in you except the will, which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose a common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Rudyard Kipling wrote that poem, If, in 1895. Today, perhaps, we have to substitute presidents for kings. Being a man might not be something that the fairer sex aspire to, but so what? These are just little details. Kipling's advice on how we should live our lives is still very inspiring, to me at least. If only everyone would live like that. Let's listen to what Bill Hicks had to say about how we might all live together.
It's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream radio show. And now I welcome my friend and co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we're going to welcome our special guests, Greg Paul and Frank Cordero. Greg Paul has had a long-time interest in environmental issues in general and renewable energy in particular. He lived for a number of years off the grid in a wood-heated home powered by a wind turbine atop an 80-foot steel tower. He's the author of 6 books on sustainable living, most recently Power from the People, How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects. Frank Cordero has appeared on the show several times. He'll discuss the upcoming Iowa Occupy Iowa protest at the World Food Prize event. The Occupy movement will target the corporate ownership of the World Food Prize, especially its dominance by genetically modified seed interests. And so tonight we are gathering together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Des Moines, Vermont, and wherever you are. Websites and articles of particular note that I'd like to mention are, one is Veterans Today, Jeff Prager, 9/11 Dust, which shows how 9/11 was a nuclear event. 9/11 certainly a false flag operation, also on Veterans Today, which shows how 9/11 was perpetrated by the Israeli Mossad. And by Kevin Barrett, this is also on Veterans Today. Israel seeks war on Iran to keep a lid on 9/11, and this is a quote from Kevin's article. Some of the same high-level sources who finger Richard Clark as the U.S. boss of the Israeli-instigated 9/11 false flag operation also claim that President Obama, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Dempsey, and other powerful Americans are considering exposing the truth about 9/11 during a second Obama term. In other words, Obama's re-election could put Israel out of business and get Netanyahu hanged from the nearest lamppost. No wonder Netanyahu is overplaying his hand by doing everything he can to get rid of Obama. And no wonder Netanyahu is desperately trying to throw gasoline on the clash of civilizations fire and trigger war with Iran. A huge Middle East war, no matter how destructive, would maintain the wartime state of emergency in the U.S. and impede the inexorable revelation of America's biggest state secret that American traitors, including Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, George W. Bush, Richard Myers, and others, helped Israel blow up the World Trade Center, bomb the Pentagon, and kill 3,000 Americans on September 11th, 2001. And that's from Kevin Barrett's article. And I would say, if this is true, if Obama is planning to be all he can be, then that's great, but I really doubt it. Personally, I take it personally when he does not do what he can to get to the truth when he's had a chance about what's been going on. That he attacks other countries for no reason, does not stop torturing and imprisoning, that he did not go after universal health care with reckless abandon, all of that. Even if he thinks that going after all that would mean to put his own life in danger. I think that's his job. That's the job description of the president. Actually, of all of us, the job description of being human is to go for it, to do all we can. We all know where this ends anyway. We're all dying. We're all terminal, all day to day, just like a Monday morning NFL injury report. It's our job to go for it, even if we put our own lives in danger. We owe it to ourselves and to each other. So I have hope that Obama will change, but I do not trust him, especially after the way he was kind of herded to us by the mainstream media lapdogs who yipped and yipped at Dennis Kucinich and Cynthia McKinney, two actual candidates, clearing the way up to the gate and on up to the big house for good old Black Barack. I do not trust him since he seems to have familial and personal ties to the CIA. I do not trust him, especially after he lied to my face that night when he said Osama bin Laden had been killed and buried at sea. Once a liar, well, anyway, I think all we can do, each of us, is to do whatever we ourselves can do. Whatever it is that amounts to is pretty much how it's going to be. To leave it to these so-called powerful men and women is to be deceived and disappointed time and time again, over and over and over. Okay, then, in keeping with the theme I began a couple weeks ago, I wanted to say something about why I think all the things I think about our country and government, like conspiracies, not that it matters or that there's anything wrong with it, only because it might be something to talk about here for a little while. Well, as I said before, I got involved in the protest or peace movement or whatever you want to call it back in the seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota in 1979. After I left the seminary, I went to New York City and volunteered at the Catholic Worker for a short while, then returned to Nebraska. Ruth and I were married. I coached and taught for a while, and all the while continued to become more interested in paying attention to the peace movement. It was somewhere there in the early 80s that I got arrested for the first time at Offutt Air Force Base south of Omaha. It was very traumatic getting arrested on purpose and not for minor possession or public intoxication. And it was like breaking up with America. It was like letting go, and at first I did not like it. Well, I continued to go to Offutt, cross the line, get arrested, ended up doing 10 days in the Sarpy County Jail in Papillion, Nebraska. I took a bus from Norfolk, to Omaha to do my sentence, and back at Norfolk I began a job as the youth ministry coordinator at Sacred Heart Parish. I continued to get arrested a couple of times. I tacked my banner and bar letters from the Air Force on the bulletin board at the church. I wrote a letter to the youth ministers saying we were not teaching the children to be Christians, only rich Catholics. I did a highly publicized walk from Norfolk to Omaha during Easter week and got arrested at Offutt. I wrote letters to the editor about the United States military and played softball with my high school friends in the evening. It was all very surreal, strange, trying to exist in the old world while plunging into the outer space of this new world I was exploring. Very difficult. I publicly criticized the country, the church. Ruth and I started our own little Catholic worker house in Norfolk and a soup kitchen. This was during the Reagan years. The soup kitchen idea was criticized on the local radio station as being a plot to make the country look bad. It was all gut-wrenching, difficult, mind-blowing, I suppose. What was on my mind was the saying by Jesus to leave all and follow him. I was trying to do that and finding out just how tough that row is to hoe. But one of the most difficult was standing outside the military recruiter's offices on Main Street with a sign that had something to do with Thou Shalt Not Kill, and seeing one of my old high school drinking and baseball playing buddies drive past on his way to work and shaking his head. The recruiters shortly after moved their offices to the new mall. I got arrested there and spent a little time in the city jail. Well, Sam was born, and shortly after, Ruth and I and Sam moved to Omaha. We moved into something called the Greenfields Resistance Community. We were there a while, and during that time, I did more jail sentences for actions in office and one for a sit-in at an Omaha congressman's office to protest aid to the military of El Salvador to kill peasants. I did 30 days, 50 days, and then 6 months, and then another 6 months. I was in the Omaha County Jail, Douglas County, the Lincoln County Jail, which is Lancaster, also the Council Bluffs, Iowa County Jail, which is Pottawatomie County, also the downtown Chicago Federal Prison, MCC, Metropolitan Correctional Center, Terre Haute Federal Penitentiary, Leavenworth Penitentiary, the Midland, Texas City Jail, and Latuna Federal Prison, FCI, just outside El Paso. There were actually some good times in jail and prison, some good memories, but overall it was a long string of extreme depression that I could only describe as horrific. I've had some depression since, but nothing like it. When you have it really bad, it's like, I don't know. You hate food, hate the idea of food, can't stand to eat. At least for me, I got rashes on the palms of my hands, extremely paranoid, and you have kind of a feeling in your chest, like a fat fifth grader is sitting on your chest. And even physical movement is like in slow motion. You have to force yourself, watch yourself as if in someone else's movie, reach to the desk to pick up a pencil. It's very strange. The last time I was in federal court in Omaha, the judge actually gave me a choice between being transferred to the Federal Medical Penitentiary in Springfield, Missouri, or staying in the Council Bluffs County Jail. I had heard stories about Springfield, so I chose Council Bluff. And to get through that 6 months, I was given Xanax 3 times a day. It's kind of hard to kick once I was released, but anyway. The whole thing just proved to be too much for me. Part of it was being away from my family, my wife and son. I remember having a photo of Sam with his big bird. I think it was about 2 or so. Standing in the lane out at Ruth's parents' farm in South Dakota, and that photo, that little colored photo, was like my icon, my totem, the thing I lived by, that photo sitting on my prisoner or jail desk. Oh, well, the details of all this, as perhaps with any former prisoner, would be too boring or too difficult to talk about. I did get into a fight in Chicago, and one thing I cannot believe happened was being in a lockdown cell in that high-rise Chicago prison and having about 20 Hispanic inmates at my door pounding on it, screaming at me after my fight with the other prisoner. That was pretty hard, pretty strange. And I remember being at Leavenworth and having breakfast in that huge dining hall, and it was on a transit bus. We were on our way from, Terre Haute to El Paso. Well, being in that big dining hall in the morning, I could find the clock for breakfast, and I was thinking that the Birdman of Alcatraz and Leonard Peltier had actually been there. So it was like a sightseeing tour for someone who was interested in that sort of stuff. And walking to Terre Haute Penitentiary, it was those big brick walls there, and having the guards, you get off the bus, and then the guards form a circle or a half circle with their shotguns or whatever kind of guards. Having the guards standing there with their guns, very willing to shoot us if we did anything wrong, and much the same feeling walking off the prison bus late at night up those big steps to Leavenworth. It was about midnight, I suppose, in the rain, there was lightning, just like a movie. With your ankles and wrists handcuffed, I remember standing in an interior room inside the front door when we got up to the top, staring at the wall. And there was a Native American prisoner next to me, and I must have had a wide-eyed look because he said to me, "Yeah, you're here." Well, that's some of it. It is possible that a prison experience gives one a jaded view of America, but I actually don't think that's, I don't know. The way I see it is that walking into an American prison with American guns on you is, I believe, a more realistic educational experience than 10th grade American history in Norfolk Senior High School. Okay, next week maybe I'll say a little more about protesting against the Catholic Church in Omaha, and maybe something about being on the run from the FBI and interviewing Leonard Peltier as a reporter in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Okay, thanks. Okay, back to you, Chuck.
Well, now we bring you the new American Dream Masterpiece Classic Playhouse Theater something something. Real voices with a message you will not hear on the CBS Nightly News.
Now we hear the voice of Fred Hampton, member of the Black Panther Party, who was gunned down in a raid by members of the Chicago Police Department on December 4th, 1969.
If you're asked to make a commitment at the age of 20 and you say, I don't want to make a commitment only because of the simple reason I'm too young to die, I want to live a bit longer, what you did is, well, you're dead already. You have to understand that people have to pay the price for peace. If you dare to struggle, you dare to win. If you dare not struggle, then God damn it, you don't deserve to win. Let me say peace to you if you're willing to fight for it. And I believe that I'm going to do my job. And I believe that I was born not to die in a car wreck. I don't believe I'm going to die from slipping on a piece of ice. I don't believe I'm going to die because I've got a bad heart. I don't believe I'm going to die of lung cancer. I think I'm going to be able to die doing the things I was born for. I believe I will be able to die as a revolutionary. Why don't you love the people? Why don't you struggle for the people? Why don't you die for the people?
Nominations are currently being accepted to rename all the places we have named for horrible people. Ronald Reagan National Airport, the 10th Mountain Division Highway, the 90th Infantry Division Highway, the 173rd Division Airborne Brigade Memorial Highway, Gerald Ford Memorial Highway, George Bush Intercontinental Airport. If we are going to name things after famous bad people, then why not, well, how about Ted Bundy National Cemetery, John Wayne Gacy International Airport, or Jeffrey Dahmer Memorial Highway, the Charles Manson Space Needle? Rather, here's a thought. Why not name things for good people rather than terrible people? Why not Dan and Phil Berrigan International Airport, Dorothy Day Interstate, the Emma Goldman Freeway? Brought to you by Citizens for Naming Things After Good People Rather Than Horrible People. And this from your local public library. There is one Tooth Fairy and one Santa and one Easter Bunny. And there are 900 second-in-command of something called Al-Qaeda, and we kill him every day that we need to cover up something else we are doing. That message was brought to you by your local American Myth System. Also, we're being sponsored tonight by Greatest Generation Beer, brewed from the finest something-something. Look for the long-haired hippie on the red, white, and blue can, because it's not about killing just because somebody tells you to and not being smart enough to think for yourself. It's all about the courage to fight for what is really right. Greatest Generation Beer. It is actually great.
Tonight, our first guest is Greg Paul, who's written a book called Power from the People: How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects. Greg has many years of experience in the energy, in renewable energy and local energy concepts, and I'm looking forward to talking to him. Greg, welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show.
Hi, Chuck. It's a pleasure to be with you tonight.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you got here? I mean, you know, your history with community energy, and you know, how you came to write your new book.
Okay. Well, about 6 years ago, I wrote a previous book called The Citizen Energy Powered Handbook, which was about community-based energy projects in North America. And when I wrote that book, many of the examples that I had to use, however, were from Europe, which has had a lot more experience in these sorts of projects and has been involved in these things for many more years than we have here in the United States. And when I came to write the latest book, I had very little trouble finding examples of these types of projects in North America now, because many more communities have begun to get involved in these things, and also the rules and the regulations and the approval process for these sorts of projects have become a little bit easier in recent years. So you're just seeing a lot more of this type of activity here in the United States now.
To what do you attribute the change? Is it public consciousness or changes in government regulations?
I think it's a combination of those things. I think people are becoming more and more aware of just how dependent we are on fossil fuels, and I think more and more people are beginning to realize that although there have been some recent discoveries of additional oil and gas deposits in the United States, fossil fuels are still ultimately a limited resource that will eventually run out. And then we need to start making plans to make that shift away from fossil fuels and towards a much broader array of renewable energy resources. But the governments, both national, state, and local, are beginning to get the message as well. And there have been a lot of activists for community-based projects who have lobbied pretty hard to get some of the more onerous rules and regulations change to make it easier for local projects.
Where do you see the biggest potential changes happening? What it would be in transportation, in home energy, what sector?
I think we're going to be seeing these changes in all of these sectors because every one of those sectors is a part of the larger picture. And the problems that we face are substantial enough, and the need for changes is great enough so that any progress that we can make in any one of those sectors is going to go towards making us more resilient and more secure, ultimately, in the long run. So it's a combination of all of those different things.
Well, on a personal level, I do my part by riding a bicycle in public transportation instead of having my own car.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a great thing for an awful lot of people to do. People really don't need their private cars. So what's your take on that?
Yes, Chuck, it's a really good strategy to follow, and it's one that many people can do as long as they don't live too far away from where they work, assuming that you're commuting by bike. I mean, many urban areas have new bike lanes and things like that. It makes it a lot easier than it formerly was to ride a bike in city traffic. But if you live in a rural location, and most of where I live in Vermont is pretty rural, there aren't a lot of public transportation options for many of those
locations.
I'm sure. And if you live out in the suburbs or out in the country, any distance, it's just not practical to ride a bike every day to work. So in a case like that where you don't have those types of options, it's even possible that in the not-too-distant future, a lot of folks are going to be moving closer to where they work or working closer to where they live. And that's one fairly simple way of drastically cutting your carbon footprint.
Well, that certainly makes sense. tell us about some other ways.
Well, I think that the main focus of the new book is to encourage people to do whatever they can on an individual family basis to tighten up their homes, make them more energy efficient, add whatever renewable energy strategies that they can afford for themselves. But going beyond that, the problems that we face in terms of making this shift away from fossil fuels are substantial enough that it really requires not only a local individual initiative, but local community-based projects as well. And that really is the main focus of the book. There are a lot of advantages to a local community-based project. They create new jobs and business opportunities. They provide energy security and price stability over the long term. They generally expand the tax base. In many cases, they generate new income. They get people directly involved in these projects from the very beginning. And probably most important of all, these types of projects retain more money in the local economy. This is all about strengthening the local economy. When you start to talk to local people about that, doesn't matter what their politics is, they can all pretty much agree that a stronger local economy is a good idea.
That's certainly true. That should cut across the party lines or whatever.
It really does.
We're starting to get a little short on time, but you have about maybe 3 minutes to tell us if there's any examples that you know of where a community energy project has gotten started.
Sure.
Hopefully in the United States.
Yes.
And also to tell people where they can find your book.
Okay. I can give you one quick example of a community solar project, which I was personally involved in here in Vermont. It was first proposed in 2010 by members of the Acorn Renewable Energy Co-op. And Acorn is an acronym that stands for Addison County Relocalization Network. And this was a 148-kilowatt project composed of 528 solar PV panels for generating electricity, covered about an acre of land, and it's a collaboration between the town of Middlebury, Vermont, and two local cooperatives, the Acorn Energy Co-op and the Cooperative Insurance Companies, also of Middlebury. The town of Middlebury supplied the site, which was otherwise unusable land, at a decommissioned sewage treatment plant, and the co-op insurance companies provided the equity investment, which offered them some real nice tax advantages, and the Acorn Energy Co-op developed the project and provided some of the funding from its members. There was a new legal entity called the Acorn Energy Solar One LLC that managed this $666,000 project and also secured the primary debt financing from Vermont Economic Development Authority and also a local bank. The entire planning and approval process took 18 months, and the actual construction only took 39 days. So that really helps to put the whole project into perspective. Most of the time and energy is involved with pulling all the pieces together and getting all the players lined up and having everything happen according to schedule. The construction was relatively straightforward by comparison.
Oh, that sounds, good old red tape. It's always
yep.
the thing that clogs things up.
Yep. But I will say that the project is producing a little bit more electricity than we had projected. We're all very happy with the way it's worked out. And the three main participants in the project each get a third of the electricity from this project. And the Acorn Energy Co-op's third was further subdivided into 16 individual subscriber accounts for some of our co-op members. So it's really truly a collaborative community project, and it was the first municipal co-op collaboration for a project of this type in the state of Vermont, and we actually won a governor's award for it, so we're really happy with the way it went.
Well, that sounds great. All right, we're about out of time. The book is Power from the People, and what's the best place for people to find it?
The simplest place is to go to gregpaul.com. That's GREGPAHL.com.
Okay, that sounds good. And for the people that forget that, they could probably find it on Amazon, right?
Yes, yes, very easily.
Okay. Thank you very much, Greg, for joining us tonight. It was a very informative interview, and we might want to get you back for a follow-up in a few months.
Sure, that would be great. Thank you, Chuck, for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Have a good night.
Yep.
Hello, and a pleasant evening to you all. Now we ask that you sit back, relax, maybe enjoy some popcorn, a beverage, listen to another episode of We Were Weathermen. We Were Weathermen is sponsored by Jiffy Plop, big ol' popcorn, and all you can ask for from a little old seed. Get a buttload of Jiffy Plop today! Now we pop in again to visit the ongoing world of We Were Weathermen. Steve and Sally Storm sat silently surveying seashells on the seashore, sailing ships. The ships were sewn cigarette packs and swizzle sticks. But there were no ships, no shells, no seashore. Only the silence was sentient, alive, breathing, real. "So, Steve," said Sally, softly, yet sort of seriously. "Yeah, what?" he said. That was how the morning went, as it often did. The two married weather persons in their cubicle at the station, dreaming their tropical dreams, each just knowing what the other was dreaming. The two storms did the weather for station WMOKS in St. Joe. Being weather persons was not their first career choice, not what Sid Bramowitz and Alicia McCarthy had dreamed of back in their days at Columbia University, sitting in the primary colored chairs in the outer office of the newly founded Tourism Management Department. How did they know it was only a front for the CIA and there would be no internship with Hilton of Honolulu or Russian ballet tour group to Tashkent, as the many-colored department brochure had proclaimed? They'd been told by Mr. Phelps, their faculty advisor. They were already a team, a couple, famous on the South Lawn with their long strides, their long yellow hair strolling hand in hand. As part of the requirements for the tourism management major, they would need to become part of the local student groups, to seek out the individuals in those groups, find out their likes and interests, in order to more efficiently serve their travel and tourism needs. Mr. Phelps suggested the weathermen. So Sid and Alicia made bombs in their dorm rooms and the off-campus apartments of the other students in the group after the bars and the library closed. And after they completed their papers and turned them in, they were told they needed to go on to the internship portion of tourism management, which was a weatherman relocation program, as it were. They'd become actual weather persons as part of their graduation requirements, which Alicia, Sally, was starting to wonder about. Mr. Phelps was so often such a kidder. But even so, he'd taken to the job, learned all about fronts and arrows on maps and big dipping lines and altocumulus clouds and shit. Their shared cubicle was stacked and packed with various weather props, part of their show, their shtick, their routine. Little doodads helped a lot when they went out to the different schools to do talks about the weather. The giant Scruffy, the lost tornado dog. Jimmy, the drowned duck. All that fun stuff. And they'd come to love the weather. Wanted to call a spade a spade. That's so racist. That's what Alicia Sally had said. "Okay, a shovel then," said Sid Steve. No weatherman had actually yet said the words global warming on camera. But the word unseasonably was becoming a real problem for from overuse. Cliche. The weather is nothing if not current, new, hip. They heard rumblings in the restrooms at the various weather conferences held in Amarillo. And after the first usage of global warming, it would be all over. Then eventually even the Today Show weatherman would be forced to follow suit. There'd be no more weather. Well, for a while, there'd be lots of weather, lots of work. Probably even a few new meteorology schools constructed to handle the load. But after the tornadoes and the floods and all the rest, all let through by that first utterance of the term, things would settle like flat water on a lake. That would be that. All that would be left for the weather person to do would be to make a brief appearance on camera, make a joke with the host at the news desk and the sports guy over there, smile and throw up the hands and say, "Well, folks, it's hot," and then go home. Pretty soon, there would be automated graphics packages to do even that tiny bit, and there would be no more need for the jolly, quirky weather guy or the weather girl with the giant boobs. It would be gone. All gone. It would be the fault of Sid and Alicia, a.k.a. Steve and Sally Storm. We've blown the whistle just as they ended the revolution. And then where would they go? Where would Mr. Phelps send them now? What requirements were they still lacking for their degrees? Maybe they'd be sent to drive the ice cream truck and ring the bell up and down the dirt streets in Valentine, Nebraska, or be grizzly bear hunting guides in southwest Jersey. They wanted to have a family, settle down, but they needed their degrees first. First thing an employer is going to ask. They needed a base, a foundation, someplace to start. Sid, Steve, looked online to try to get information from the Columbia Registrar, but found out he did not exist. Had never attended Columbia, had no college credit. After how many years? Well, anyway, show must go on. 5 p.m., just like the sun coming up every morning, Steve and Sally Storm put on their game faces, got ready, and sprang into action. Steve and Sally Storm in their salty, secure, somnolent circle cubicle at the carefully choreographed queue, like synchronized swimmers, pushed back their chairs from their computers, bumping their backs. Swiveling around, they stood to high-five and trot out to the set. "It's happening! St. Joe!" they both screamed when it came their turn, squatting and firing pistol shots with pointed index fingers at the camera. "Hey, it's hot out there today, huh?" smiled Steve. "Looks like we're in for some weather." Sally smooshed her face up close to the camera. "Unseasonably warm, looks like," said Steve, as he moved to the side and pointed at his map with the big blow-up red and yellow pencil that he cuddled in both arms. Sally handed out red, yellow, and green suckers to the cameraman and the news team. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode of We Were Weathermen, when we'll find out what Steve and Sally Storm do when one of them gets blue screenophobia and one can't find the pointer. Buy some Jiffy Plop right now!
Coming this fall on CBS, Survivor Nebraska. You will survive uncomfortable family holidays, uber patriotic tractor parades, teachers who teach fake American history. Survivor Nebraska, you will be dropped in the middle of town between the cannon and the church and the elevator and the bank and Arby's and be expected to learn to survive by speaking the native tongue, never using words of more than two syllables. Welcome. Do what we say and you can live out your days in Nebraska. It's a nice place. We like it here. We've never been anywhere else. Neither will you. If you do not learn to follow the rules of Survivor Nebraska, you will live to regret it. You can say whatever you like, but if you say something we don't like, you will live forever a stranger among us. The tribe has spoken. Funding for tonight. Chuck, the phone is on the air.
Hello?
Hello, Frank?
Yes.
is the radio show, and we're going to be ready for you in about 3 minutes. I accidentally put you live. Mike's going to finish something first.
Okay. You know, I tried to call earlier, and I didn't get through, so I thought I was put on hold, and I tried your other numbers, so I was I didn't know what was going on.
Why don't we just go with it now? Frank, are you there? Frank?
Yes.
Are you ready now?
Well, sure. Hold on here.
I'll introduce you, Frank.
Okay, go ahead.
Frank Cordero is a former Des Moines Dowling football player, wrestler, a former Catholic priest. He's been many times a prisoner in federal prison and county jails, and he's the founder and longtime member of the Des Moines Catholic Worker. Frank has done a plowshares action. He's been arrested in front of Jimmy Carter at a press conference, and no doubt lots of other stuff. Frank, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Michael. It's good to hear your voice.
Good to hear your voice. What's happening? What's that? Go ahead.
What I want to talk about is the Occupy the World Food Prize. And just to give people a little context, Iowa is the center of the U.S. agriculture, of course, and Des Moines has what they call the World Food Prize, and they bill it as the Nobel Prize for Food, and it's just a real extraordinary cover for corporate agriculture and the titans and giants who control the world and our food supply and have a direct hand in the deterioration of the conditions of the planet. Well, they get wealthy, and people are not satisfied by the way food is being distributed and grown and who's profiting. So it's an opportunity when people like Monsanto and DuPont and Pioneer and the state of Iowa and rich folks like the Ruans put millions of dollars into this prize, has a large foundation for it, and they select these recipients to come and get their awarded for achievements in feeding the world when the vast majority of the recipients, good or bad, their work is always feeds the corporate model of agriculture. So we're doing what we call Occupy the World Food Prize. We're going to be doing programs, education, street stuff, and civil disobedience in an effort to poise a different narrative, a different story, a different way to look at the food system in the world that feeds people instead of feeds corporations. So that's quite an agenda, and it's something we know we won't get done in the first year, but we plan to keep doing this year in, year out, and make this a flashpoint for all the world's people trying to change the food systems that are so directly connected to the deterioration of the planet and human insecurity.
When is it again, Frank?
October 16th to the 20th. The web page is OccupyTheWorldFoodPrize.com, you can read about it. We're taking the lessons we learned this last winter with our own Iowa Occupy the Caucuses, which we believe were very successful. So only we understand that going against the corporate food system in Iowa is less popular than going against nuclear weapons in the 70s. So we know we have our job cut out for us.
Are you getting any support from local farm groups or farmers?
Well, a lot of the progressive farm people know what we're doing. They agree with our critique. But having not been very exposed to civil disobedience and using that as a tool in your social movements, most people are hesitant right now. They just don't know what to think about using that as a tactic in this struggle.
Okay. Would you mind switching a little bit and talking about the trial in the drone trial, and was it in Kansas City?
Yes, I did not attend, but I believe that they tried to put the drones on trial justifiably with expert witnesses having to do with the international law, and of course the judges prevented any of that actually happening in the courtroom, and predictably they were our friends were all found guilty. Mark Kinney pled guilty, and he is just completing a four-month sentence. And then Brian and Paul are, I believe, to be sentenced sometime in October, having already been found guilty of trespass. So these things go on all over the country, efforts to try to bring the, you know, the true criminal activity that the government is doing through the nuclear weapons systems, and the courts continue to give them cover.
Okay, Frank. Thanks a lot. Anything else?
Go to jails. Just that the fight goes on, and it's good to hear your voice, Michael.
Yeah. Hey, tell us one more time.
Mike, it's your program.
No, it's your program, Frank. You know that.
Thanks.
Tell us it one more time. When the food prize Occupy thing is going on?
October 16th to October 20th. It's called Occupy the World Food Prize. If you go and you just type in OccupyTheWorldFoodPrize.com, we'll come up and check out the webpage. Come, and we're providing hospitality for all out-of-towners, so plenty of room. Come join us in this first of many years where the fight for the planet will have a flashpoint and a turning point here in Des Moines.
Okay, and let's say somebody wants to come and join the Des Moines Catholic Worker. How would they get that done? How would they start that?
Well, you got to get a hold of us. And again, the Des Moines Catholic Worker. Probably Google that. You'll probably come up with something. You just got to come and visit. People just got to come. Okay. Catholic workers are tangible stuff. You can't. You got to live it to get a sense of it. So, and it's no big deal. It's just coming and visiting folks doing good work.
What's the address of Berrigan House?
Berrigan House is 713 Indiana Avenue, Des Moines, Iowa, 50314.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Frank, and keep up the good work, and we'll talk to you again soon, okay?
Thanks, brother. All right.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Yep, bye.
This portion of our program is being provided to you by the good folks at The Next Big Thing. New apps for your phone. More stuff for you to do while you're doing that boring driving thing. Well, folks, hold on to your hats, because this new app is going to rock your world. It's the application that allows you to understand UFOs, Bigfoot, and conspiracies are real. Download it today. Well, maybe tomorrow. We're working on it. The third season of Finding Bigfoot starts in November. Find it on the Animal Planet Network or by sitting in the McDonald's parking lot using their internet service. We're getting dangerously close to the time when everyone will know that Bigfoot exists. We're not sure if you're ready for that. That's why we're working overtime on new apps for you. We kind of like being one of the ones in the know, knowing about something so magical that others don't yet realize, but soon that will not be possible.
A quote from author Richard Dolan: "The moment of disclosure, UFOs, is not the end of anything. It's the beginning of the real fight for truth. We saw demonstrations of a million people in Tahrir Square. Don't you think there might be a march of a million people on Area 51, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Los Alamos? Maybe. I'll bet you Wackenhut Security can stop a march of 100 people, but not a million, not a million. And don't you think that just might happen? And what about opening up a new truth movement? Because after UFOs, then 9/11, JFK, underground bases, you name it, chemtrails, it's all going to be on the table. By God, what an exciting, challenging mess it's going to be. And so, in other words, the moment of disclosure is not going to be the end of anything. It's the beginning for the real fight for truth, not the end.
The folks at the next big thing ask you, be careful what you hope for, huh? What happens the day that Barack Obama and George W. Bush and his father are walked out of the golf course in handcuffs, charged with prior knowledge and hiding information about a felony, the attacks of 9/11? And a thoughtful U.S. Marshal puts his hand on George Sr.'s head so he doesn't bump it on the door when we get the final public sneer of that career criminal. It appears on the front page of the New York Post and Time Magazine and Rolling Stone. What happens when the talk about UFOs and Bigfoot and the Wellstone murder are about details of where and when and how, rather than a rolling of the eyes? What happens when we have actual names and court cases and confessions and Newsweek and Wall Street Journal and New York Times front page stories about the trial of some still living principals in the JFK, RFK, and Martin Luther King Jr. murders? Our whole world will be rocked. And somebody will need to make an app for that in a darn big hurry. But thanks to the folks at the next big thing, it's all already in the works, guys. Things will be different. Our whole perception of life and what we should be doing in life will be changed forever. Might be scary, but it's where we need to go. Down the rabbit hole, folks. Step right up. Don't be shy. Okay, now, careful. One at a time, no pushing. Everybody will get their turn. Easy now. Careful. There you go. We're the next big thing. We bring your world to your vehicle, your doorstep, right on up to your mind.
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. It's election season in Washington, D.C., and Ames, Iowa, and Amarillo, and Mount Liberty. Mount Liberty and the Congressional District have a new candidate. Joe Coffey might be called a non-traditional candidate, kind of the way they refer to the older folks taking education and sociology classes over at Wayne State College. Joe is, well, what is Joe anyway? He's a family man with problems fitting in. He would have been a hero at Bukowski if Bukowski would have ever heard of him or if he had ever heard of Bukowski. Joe is no Joe America. He's not a father you'd find in the front yard smoking a pipe, stopping the lawnmower in his crisp white T-shirt for a moment to chat with the neighbors. Some say if God had wanted us to vote, he would have sent us candidates. Well, maybe he sent us one, just the one, to see how we would handle it. As we learned last week, Joe has told Jane he wants to run for Congress. Actually, this all happened last spring, was it? But the real backstory to the whole Joe Coffey thing is just beginning to circulate around town. At first, Jane was nonplussed at learning that her shy, defeated husband wanted to get up on the political stage, but after a few moments of catching her breath, she was on board, full steam, ready to kick some butt.
They stood together behind the curtain, watching stragglers leave the school. Upstairs, something bounced. The refrigerator hummed. The air conditioner kicked in. They beat you down once. And he bowed his head. His shoulders bounced her chin. You're rested. Now make them come do it again. And again and again. She let his hands cover hers. This is my effing country, and I will do as I like. Joe recognized the paraphrase Stephen Biko. That was going a bit far. He was not Biko. Sometimes Jane tried to be too supportive, nudging him into the clearing when he was not at all comfortable. In fact, even taking out the garbage in daylight was outside his comfort zone. So Joe's comfort zone had become lying on the sofa with a dirty blue afghan over his head. But he wanted her to be proud. He wanted the kids to not be embarrassed of him. He wanted to forget how he drove away the night that Charlie Calhoun was crucified in front of the cathedral instead of him. We have every right to live here, to be ourselves, and screw whoever doesn't get it, because you know they really don't matter. Joe lifted his chin to feel her head. He tasted his tears. I love you, she said. Well, now he done it. His cheeks had dried, and a crystal pair of sweat began its journey around his hairline. Joe stared at the red brick school that needed repair, did not notice the ice on his own roof beginning to melt, dripping past the window. Jane and Joe huddled around their kitchen table that night, making plans over a bottle of Chi-Chi's margarita mix, Marlboros, taco chips, dip, and two new yellow legal pads. The kids swarmed around the dining room table doing their homework and crawling under the table from chair leg to chair leg in one complete circle without touching the floor. Or they'd burn up in one instant because the carpet is the sun. It is. By 7:30 and 4/5 of the bottle, Jane was the campaign manager and the campaign committee. They knew no one else would do it. Jane drew a perfect tease while Joe made a stick people neighborhood scene with a big sun and a big red daisy in the front yard. Not easy, he said. You want to do this or not, she said. Here, look at this. Pinning her pad toward him. Death penalty. Immigration. Farms. Military budget. Global warming. Depleted uranium. Prisons. Joe scanned her list. I could give a shit about farms, he said. You have to care about farms, said Jane. Over 90% of the land in your district is used for agriculture. Farming is the biggest industry by far. You have to care about it. My district? Well, I don't, said Joe. Honey. I hate honey. Like to see deer hunters get county jail time. Put that down. He pointed to Jane's pad, to then wrote it down on his own. Oh, well, how about the rest of this, she asked, yawned. Pigs, confinements, said Joe. Slaughter barns, houses, buildings, where they kill cows and swine for food. He smoothed a few light hairs on his upper lip. Maybe there's a way we could get that stopped or slowed down? He looked at Jane. No. She shook her head, rested her pen on the table. You don't have any idea, do you? Well, probably not, he said. He laughed. He looked at her to try to coax her to laugh. Shut down the slaughterhouses, let the cows go free, elect me. Joe stood up and began waltzing circles in the kitchen with an imaginary partner. He pulled Jane up by the elbow and began to twirl her. They twirled and twirled and fell to the floor, dizzy and laughing. Ben looked up, saw the children crowded in the doorway, astonished as characters in Oliver Twist who'd just seen a policeman giggle. Oh. Hi, guys, said Jane. He slumped against the stove, sweating, trying to catch her breath. Mommy and Daddy are just having fun. He lay on his back, his chest heaving. He traced a water stain from the cupboard under the upstairs tub to the tile above the basement door. I want to tell the churches, those normal church members.
Oh. Hello.
I want to ask them why they let people die, live in squalor. He put one finger up, looked over, and noticed the children had returned to their table to do their homework in silence. I want to ask somebody about liberation theology. Do we just let poverty and riches happen? Just sit by and watch whatever happens like we're watching television? I want to get out there with a shotgun and take from the rich. He began to play with the hair on his chin, puffing it with the back of his hand. He noticed his voice was deeper when he felt confident. I want to sit at the four-way and drag those rich folks out of the shiny cars and leave them lay in a slop in their church clothes. He turned his head, saw that Jane had gone to the back porch to start a load of whites. A thought of Charlie Calhoun flashed across the screen of Joe's mind movie. That's the kind of campaign I want to have, he told the stained tile and ceiling fan on low speed. The back door opened and closed, letting in a shock of cold. We need brochures, said Jane. She stood over a pad and wrote while holding a full green plastic basket under her other arm. Then she turned and stood above Joe on the floor. Joe thought her upside-down mouth and chin reminded him of a whale. I think that's what you should get first, is a brochure. She romped through the living room and ruffled the hair of the nearest kid.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO church group volunteer leaf rakers are about average.
And that's the end of this episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we hope you'll come back to listen next week, same time, same place. We'd like to thank worldnewstrust.com for hosting our website, and thespiritualun.org for helping us to bring the show to you each week. Thanks, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm down there. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Oh.